This is Audible.
Jane Austen's Emma, dramatized for audio by Anna Lee, directed by Katherine Thompson. An Audible Studios production for Audible Originals.
Mrs. Weston, how strange that I cannot call you Miss Taylor any longer. Forgive me for not joining the wedding breakfast. I must return with Papa. You know how large parties tire him.
Of course.
Mrs. Weston, I wish you all the joy your heart can hold.
Dearest Emma, you have a good portion of that heart, and ever shall.
I shall miss you terribly. Well, I must not keep you from your carriage. Mr. Weston is waiting for you.
Do not worry. It shall not be long before we see you again. But I must be going. Goodbye, dear Emma.
Goodbye.
Emma, may I join you?
Mr. Knightley. Do not look at me, I beg you. I am blushing like a schoolgirl.
Not such genuine affection does you credit. There go the newlyweds.
They are a handsome couple.
Will you join the wedding breakfast?
I cannot stay. I shall only wait for Papa. He is ready to return home. Will you join us for supper this evening?
Gladly. Tell me what I can bring to cheer you.
Oh, do not think of me.
Perhaps a slice of the cake?
Oh, yes. Only do not tell Papa. He thinks cake so unwholesome.
You live such a wholesome life, Emma. I wonder that it does not sometimes make you ill. I shall bring the cake this evening.
Hush, here comes Papa.
I shall mention nothing of the cake.
Nor any of my other faults.
Only the truest friend would agree to such a censure.
You agree then?
I do.
Emma Woodhouse. Handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence, and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. She was the youngest of the two daughters of a most affectionate, indulgent father. Her mother had died too long ago for her to have more than an indistinct remembrance of her caresses, and her place had been supplied by Miss Taylor as governess, who had fallen little short of a mother in affection. 16 years had Miss Taylor, now Mrs. Weston, been in Mr. Woodhouse's family, less as a governess than a friend. The real evils, indeed, of Emma's situation were the power of having rather too much her own way and a disposition to think a little too well of herself. These were the disadvantages which threatened to alloy her many enjoyments. The danger, however, was at present so unperceived that they did not by any means rank as misfortunes with her. It was the loss of Miss Taylor which first brought grief to Emma. The want of Miss Taylor would be felt every hour of every day. She had been a friend and companion such as few possessed, intelligent, gentle, knowing all the ways of the family, interested in all its concerns, and peculiarly interested in Emma, in all her pleasures and schemes. How was she to bear the change? It was true that her friend was going to live only half a mile from them at Randall's, but Emma was aware that she was now in great danger of suffering from intellectual solitude. She dearly loved her father, and though he had a most amiable temper, he was no companion for her. He could not meet her in conversation, rational or playful. The evil of the actual disparity in their ages, and Mr. Woodhouse had not married early, was much increased by his constitution and habits, for he was a much older man in ways than in years. nor could Emma take comfort in her sister's company, for Isabella, though but little removed by matrimony in London, was much beyond her daily reach. Emma had many acquaintances in Highbury, the large and populous village to which Hartfield belonged, but not one among them could be accepted in lieu of Miss Taylor for even half a day. It was a melancholy change, deeply felt by Emma, who was left to contemplate in the company of her dispirited father. Mr. Woodhouse was a nervous man, easily depressed, fond of everybody that he was used to, and hating to part with them, hating change of every kind. Matrimony, as the origin of change, was always disagreeable, and he was by no means yet reconciled to his own daughter's marrying. As to Miss Taylor's marriage, he could not but help voicing the fresh pain he felt each and every time he remembered the wedding.
Poor Miss Taylor. I wish she were here again. What a pity it is that Mr. Weston ever thought of her.
I cannot agree with you, Papa. You know I cannot. Mr. Weston is an excellent man. And you would not have had Miss Taylor live with us forever and bear all my odd humours when she might have a house of her own.
A house of her own? Where is the advantage in that? When Hartfield is three times as large. And you never have any odd humours, my dear. You are like your sister in that regard. Oh, poor Isabella, so far off.
She is only 16 miles off, Papa. She is perfectly within reach, and we shall be always meeting the Westons at Randall's or Hartfield. We must begin. We must go and pay our wedding visit very soon.
You are right, my dear. There is some small comfort in that, and we must seek consolation where we can.
Emma spared no exertions to maintain this happier flow of ideas while awaiting Mr. Knightley, whom she expected every moment. Mr. Knightley was a sensible man, about 7 or 8 and 30, a very old and intimate friend of the family, and the elder brother of Isabella's husband, John Knightley. He lived about a mile from Highbury, was a frequent visitor and always welcome, despite the fact that he was one of the few people who could see faults in Emma Woodhouse, and the only one who ever told her of them. His cheerful manner always did Mr. Woodhouse good, and had a happy effect upon his entering the room this evening, even if the topic, at first, remained unchanged.
Mr. Knightley, it is very kind of you to call upon us. Do not you think the wedding a sad business? Poor Miss Taylor.
Poor Mr. and Miss Woodhouse, if you please, but I cannot possibly say poor Miss Taylor. I have a great regard for you and Emma, but it must be better for Miss Taylor to have only one person to please instead of two.
Especially when one of those two is such a fanciful, troublesome creature. That is what you have in your head, I know, and what you would certainly say if my father were not by.
I believe it is very true, my dear, indeed. I'm afraid I am sometimes very fanciful and troublesome.
My dearest Papa, you do not think I could mean you, or suppose Mr. Knightley to mean you. What a horrible idea. I meant only myself. Mr. Knightley loves to find fault with me, you know, in a joke. It is all a joke. We always say what we like to one another.
Emma knows I never flatter her. But I meant no slight to anybody. I only meant that Miss Taylor has been used to having two persons to please. She will now have but one, which can only bring her ease.
I shall still call her poor Miss Taylor, for being taken from Hartfield where she was so comfortable.
In order to divert her father's thoughts from further repetition, Emma reminded him that it was time to dine. It had its effect. The perils of eating late were to be always avoided. Once they were at table, however, the refrain returned.
I do wish a happier occasion accompanied our food. Dear Emma bears everything so well, but she is really very sorry to lose poor Miss Taylor.
It is impossible that Emma should not miss such a companion, but she knows how much the marriage is to Miss Taylor's advantage, and therefore cannot allow herself to feel so much pain as pleasure.
You have forgotten one matter of joy to me, and a very considerable one, that I made the match myself. I made the match, you know, 4 years ago, and to have it take place and be proved in the right when so many people said Mr. Weston would never marry again may comfort me for anything.
Oh, my dear, I wish you would not make matches and foretell things. For whatever you say always comes to pass. Pray do not make any more matches.
I promise you to make none for myself, Papa. But I must indeed for other people. It is the greatest amusement in the world, and after such success, you know. Ever since the day that Miss Taylor and I met with Mr. Weston in Broadway Lane, when, because it began to drizzle, he darted away with so much gallantry and borrowed 2 umbrellas for us from Farmer Mitchell's, I made up my mind on the subject. I planned the match from that hour, and when such success has blessed me in this instance, dear Papa, you cannot think that I shall leave off matchmaking.
I do not understand what you mean by success. Success supposes endeavour, but if which I rather imagine your making the match, as you call it, means only your planning it, you're saying to yourself one idle day, I think it would be a very good thing for Miss Taylor if Mr. Weston were to marry her, and saying it again to yourself every now and then afterwards, why do you talk of success? Where's your merit? What are you proud of? You made a lucky guess, and that is all that can be said.
A lucky guess is never merely luck. There is always some talent in it. And as to my poor word success, which you quarrel with, I do not know that I am so entirely without any claim to it. If I had not promoted Mr. Weston's visits here, and given many little encouragements, and smoothed many little matters, it might not have come to anything after all.
A straightforward, open-hearted man like Weston, and a rational, unaffected woman like Miss Taylor, may be safely left to manage their own concerns. You are more likely to have done harm to yourself than good to them by interference.
Emma never thinks of herself if she can do good to others. But, my dear, pray do not make any more matches. They are silly things and break up one's family circle grievously.
Only one more, Papa. Only for poor Mr. Elton. You like Mr. Elton, Papa. I must look about for a wife for him. I thought when he was joining their hands in church today, he looked so very much as if he would like to have the same kind office done for him.
Mr. Elton is a very good young man, to be sure, and I have a great regard for him. But if you want to show him any attention, my dear, ask him to come and dine with us someday. That will be a much better thing. I dare say Mr. Knightley will be so kind as to join us.
With a great deal of pleasure, sir. It will be a much better thing. You are quite right. Invite him to dinner, Emma, and help him to the best of the fish and the chicken. But leave him to choose his own wife. Depend upon it, a man of 27 can take care of himself.
The conversation soon turned from weddings to less provoking topics, and the evening passed in relative ease. A wedding visit to Randall's, home of the happy Mr. and Mrs. Weston, followed but a few days later. Mr. Woodhouse could not cease to pity poor Miss Taylor, as he still called her, despite her cheerful enjoyment, which was so just and so apparent. But the passing of time brought some alleviation to Mr. Woodhouse. The compliments of his neighbours were over. He was no longer teased by being wished joy of so sorrowful an event, and the wedding cake, which had been a great distress to him, had at last been eaten. He had been at the pains of consulting Mr. Perry, the apothecary, on the subject. Mr. Perry was an intelligent, gentlemanlike man whose frequent visits were one of the comforts of Mr. Woodhouse's life. And, upon being applied to, he could not but acknowledge that wedding cake might certainly disagree with many unless taken moderately. With such an opinion, in confirmation of his own, Mr. Woodhouse hoped to influence every visitor of the newly married pair. But still, the cake was eaten, and there was no rest for his benevolent nerves till it was all gone. There was even a strange rumour in Highbury of all the little Perrys being seen with a slice of Mrs. Weston's wedding cake in their hands. But Mr. Woodhouse would never believe it. Mrs. Weston, in the meanwhile, knew that at times she must be missed, and could not think without pain of Emma's losing a single pleasure, or suffering an hour's ennui from the want of her companionableness. But dear Emma was of no feeble character. She was more equal to her situation than most girls would have been, and had sense and energy and spirits that might be hoped would bear her well and happily through its little difficulties and privations. In the village of Highbury, the wedding provided much diverting talk for a considerable time, until just as the topic of the Westons seemed exhausted, Mrs. Weston received a letter from her son-in-law. Mr. Frank Churchill, the esteemed son of Mr. Weston, was one of the boasts of Highbury, and a lively curiosity to see him prevailed, though the compliment was so little returned that he had never been there in his life. It was very generally proposed that now, upon his father's marriage, Mr. Frank Churchill's visit should take place, and the hope was strengthened by his letter, which for a few days was mentioned at every morning visit in Highbury. Mr. Weston saw his son in London each year, and was proud of him, but circumstances had prevented a closer bond. Frank's mother had died when Frank was but a few years old, leaving him in the care of his father. Soon after Mrs. Weston's decease, however, her brother and his wife, having no children of their own, offered to take the whole charge of little Frank. Some scruples and some reluctance the widower father may be supposed to have felt, but as they were overcome by other considerations, the child was given up to the care and the wealth of the Churchills. It was their name that Frank assumed, and their parental comforts that accompanied him throughout his childhood. None of this prevented a very real affection in Mr. Weston, however, and his fond report of his son as a very fine young man had made Highbury feel a sort of pride in him too. He was looked on as sufficiently belonging to the place to make his merits and prospects a kind of common concern. It was just the kind of harmless gossip that Mr. Woodhouse enjoyed talking of, with repeated refrains and a few minor variations each time he spoke of it.
I must say, Frank Churchill has greatly risen in my admiration since his letter, greatly risen. It must have been such a comfort for Mrs. Weston to receive such proper attention from Mr. Churchill. A most handsome letter. But I am forgetting the tea. Shall I pour?
Yes, thank you, Papa.
What note have you there, my dear?
It is from Mrs. Goddard. She asks if she may bring a pupil of hers to supper tonight, Miss Harriet Smith.
Do we know Miss Smith?
I know her only by sight. She has a most charming appearance.
Who are her parents?
Nobody knows whom, but they keep her in perfect comfort at Mrs. Goddard's, it seems. I heard she has been raised in status to a parlour boarder.
Well, if Mrs. Goddard promotes her, I am certain she will be a fine addition to our party.
Mr. Woodhouse was fond of society in his own way. Real, long-standing regard brought the Westons and Mr. Knightley. Invitations often extended to Mr. Elton, a young man living alone at the vicarage, without liking it, who eagerly traded an evening of his own blank solitude for the elegances and society of Mr. Woodhouse's drawing-room and the smiles of his lovely daughter. After these came a second set, among the most come-at-able of whom were Mrs. and Miss Bates and Mrs. Goddard, three ladies almost always at the service of an invitation from Hartfield, and who were regularly fetched and carried home. Mrs. Bates, the widow of a former vicar of Highbury, was a very old lady, almost past everything but tea and quadrille. She lived with her single daughter in a very small way, and was considered with all the regard and respect which a harmless old lady under such untoward circumstances can excite. Her daughter, Miss Bates, enjoyed a most uncommon degree of popularity for a woman neither young, handsome, rich, nor married. She had never boasted either beauty or cleverness. Her youth had passed without distinction, and her middle of life was devoted to the care of a failing mother, and the endeavour to make a small income go as far as possible. And yet, she was a happy woman. Miss Bates was interested in everybody's happiness and thought herself a most fortunate creature, surrounded with blessings in such an excellent mother and so many good neighbours and friends and a home that wanted for nothing. The simplicity and cheerfulness of her nature, her contented and grateful spirit, were a recommendation to everybody and a mine of felicity to herself. She was, in addition, a great talker upon little matters, which suited Mr. Woodhouse exactly. Mrs. Goddard was the mistress of a school, a real, honest, old-fashioned boarding school, where girls might be sent to be out of the way and scramble themselves into a little education without any danger of coming back prodigies. Mrs. Goddard's school was in high repute, and very deservedly, for she had an ample house and garden, gave the children plenty of wholesome food, let them run about a great deal in the summer, and in winter dressed their chilblains with her own hands. These were the ladies whom Emma found herself very frequently able to collect, and happy was she for her father's sake, though as far as she herself was concerned, it was no remedy for the absence of Mrs. Weston. The prospect of adding Miss Smith to their party, however, enlivened Emma's spirits considerably. Miss Smith was a girl of 17, whom Emma knew very well by sight and had long felt an interest in on account of her beauty, which happened to be of a sort that Emma particularly admired. She was short, plump and fair, with a fine bloom, blue eyes, light hair, regular features and a look of great sweetness. Emma's invitation caused Miss Smith as much panic as pleasure, so it was with great anticipation that she arrived at Hartfield that evening in the generous and talkative company of Mrs. and Miss Bates.
Take my arm, Mother. There. Now I shall guide the way. Miss Smith, do you mind the carriage step? Oh, you have managed it.
Good evening, Miss Bates, Mrs. Bates.
My dear Miss Woodhouse, how kind you are to greet us at the door. It is Miss Woodhouse, Mother. She cannot see well in the dark, I fear, even with her spectacles. I am afraid our party is not quite complete. Mrs. Goddard has been waylaid by one of her pupils who took a sudden turn. I dare say Mr. Woodhouse may send the carriage to retrieve her in a short while.
Of course, we shall arrange it directly.
So kind. May I introduce Miss Harriet Smith?
A pleasure to meet you, Miss Smith.
It is an honour to meet you, Miss Woodhouse. An invitation from Hartfield. I was quite overcome.
I am so pleased we can know one another.
What a delightful evening we shall have.
Come, let us go indoors.
Mind the step there, Mother. Here comes another.
The party was soon at table, enjoying spirited talk and a fine supper, and in the meanwhile Emma took great notice of young Miss Smith. Her conversation was not remarkably clever, but Emma found her altogether very engaging and pleasantly grateful for being admitted to Hartfield. Such artless good sense, however, together with her particular beauty and natural graces, should not be wasted on the inferior society of Highbury. Harriet wanted only a little more knowledge and elegance to be quite perfect. Emma resolved to improve her. She would detach her from her bad acquaintance, introduce her into good society, and would form her opinions and her manners. It would be an interesting and certainly a very kind undertaking, highly becoming her own situation in life, her leisure and powers. At the close of the evening, Miss Smith, all gratitude and humility, went off with highly gratified feelings, delighted with the affability with which Miss Woodhouse had treated her all the evening. It proved a happy connection, and one which very soon strengthened. Quick and decided in her ways, Emma lost no time in inviting, encouraging, and telling her to come very often. And as their acquaintance increased, so did their satisfaction in each other. Harriet had a sweet, docile, grateful disposition, was totally free from conceit, and only desiring to be guided by anyone she looked up to. Her inclination for good company and power of appreciating what was elegant and clever showed that there was no want of taste, though strength of understanding must not be expected. Altogether, she was quite convinced of Harriet Smith's being exactly the young friend she wanted. Such a friend as Mrs. Weston was out of the question. Two such could never be granted. Two such she did not want. It was quite a different sort of thing, a sentiment distinct and independent. Mrs. Weston was the object of a regard which had its basis in gratitude and esteem. Harriet would be loved as one to whom she could be useful. For Mrs. Weston, there was nothing to be done. For Harriet, everything.
May I ask you a question, Miss Smith? But of course, you will not think me prying, I hope. I only want to be of use where I can. Tell me, have you asked after your parents?
Mrs. Goddard says she knows nothing of them. My fees are paid by a third party.
I must say I am surprised you do not wish to know more. If I were in such a situation, I could not help but inquire until I discovered the truth.
I can have no further curiosity when I am so well provided for.
Then I shall say no more.
You must not pity me, Miss Woodhouse, not in the least. I have more than I could ever have hoped for, and fresh delights with each new season. To think I have only just passed a whole summer with the Martins, and already I am here with you at Hartfield. Of course, Abbey Mill Farm is nothing to compare with Hartfield. I should never think to say so, but it is full of charms and wonders in its own way. Do you know, Mrs. Martin has two parlours, two very good parlours indeed. One of them quite as large as Mrs. Goddard's drawing room. And they have 8 cows. And they have a very handsome summer house in their garden where some day, next year, we shall all drink tea. It was Mr. Martin's idea. He is so very good-natured. His mother and sisters are very proud of him.
Am I to understand that Mrs. Martin is his mother? Is Mr. Martin a single man?
Oh, yes. There is no Mrs. Martin in that regard.
I see.
He really is so very good-humoured and obliging. One day he went 3 miles round in order to bring me walnuts. I had said how fond I was of them, you see, and one night he had his shepherd son into the parlour to sing to me. I'm so very fond of singing. Do not you think it shows a most obliging nature, Miss Woodhouse?
It does indeed. What do you imagine his age to be?
He was 24 the 8th of last June.
Only 24. That is too young to settle.
Mrs. Martin had told me one day that it was impossible for anybody to be a better son, and she was sure whenever he married, he would make a good husband. Not that she wants him to marry. She is in no hurry at all.
Well, his mother is perfectly right. 6 years hence, if he could meet with a good sort of young woman in the same rank as his own, with a little money, it might be very desirable.
6 years hence? Dear Miss Woodhouse, he would be 30 years old.
Well, and that is as early as most men can afford to marry, who are not born to an independence. Mr. Martin, I imagine, with diligence and good luck, may be rich in time, but it is next to impossible that he should have realised anything yet.
To be sure, so it is. But they live very comfortably.
When he does marry Harriet, I wish you may not get into a scrape. I mean as to being acquainted with his wife, since he might not marry anybody at all fit for you to notice. There can be no doubt of your being a gentleman's daughter, and you must support your claim to that station by everything within your own power.
I suppose you are right, Miss Woodhouse. You are always right. I have a great regard for the Miss Martins and should be very sorry to give them up, for they are quite as well educated as me. But if Mr. Martin marries a very ignorant, vulgar woman, certainly I had better not visit her, if I can help it.
They happened to meet Mr. Martin the very next day as they were walking on the Donwell Road. Emma was not sorry to have such an opportunity of survey, and soon made her quick eye sufficiently acquainted with Mr. Robert Martin. His appearance was very neat, and he looked like a sensible young man, but his person had no other advantage, nor did he display any refinements of manner. Indeed, he did not seem to know what manner was. Emma walked a few yards forward while he spoke with Harriet. They remained but a few minutes together, as Miss Woodhouse must not be kept waiting, and Harriet then came running to her in a flutter of spirits, which Miss Woodhouse hoped very soon to compose.
only think of our happening to meet him. How very odd. It was quite a chance, he said, that he had not gone round by Randall's. Well, Miss Woodhouse, is he what you expected? What do you think of him? Do you think him so very plain?
He is very plain, undoubtedly. Remarkably plain. But that is nothing compared with his entire want of gentility. I had no idea that he could be so very clownish, so totally without air.
To be sure, he is not so genteel as real gentlemen.
I think, Harriet, at Hartfield you have had very good specimens of well-educated, well-bred men. I should be surprised if, after seeing them, you could be in company with Mr. Martin again without perceiving him to be a very inferior creature. Compare Mr. Martin with Mr. Weston, or Mr. Elton. Compare their manner of carrying themselves, of walking, of speaking, of being silent. You must see the difference.
Oh, yes, there is a great difference. But Mr. Weston is almost an old man. Mr. Weston must be between 40 and 50.
Which makes his good manners the more valuable. The older a person grows, Harriet, the more important it is that their manners should not be bad, the more glaring and disgusting any loudness or coarseness or awkwardness becomes. What is passable in youth is detestable in later age. Mr. Martin is now awkward and abrupt. What will he be at Mr. Weston's time of life?
There is no saying, indeed.
But there may be pretty good guessing. He will be a completely gross, vulgar farmer, totally inattentive to appearances and thinking of nothing but profit and loss.
Will he indeed? That will be very bad.
A gentleman's manners are the very best mark of the man. Mr. Elton, for example, is good-humoured, cheerful and gentle. Indeed, he is particularly gentle of late. If he means anything, it must be to please you. Did not I tell you what he said of you the other day?
She then repeated some warm personal praise which she had drawn from Mr. Elton, and Harriet blushed and smiled and said she had always thought him very agreeable. Mr. Elton, that good-humoured, well-meaning, respectable young man, was the very person Emma fixed on for driving the young farmer out of Harriet's head. Indeed, the plan had entered her brain during the very first evening of Harriet's coming to Hartfield. The longer she considered the match, the greater was her sense of its expediency. Mr. Elton's situation was most suitable, quite the gentleman himself and without low connections, at the same time not of any family that could fairly object to the doubtful birth of Harriet. He had a comfortable home for her, and, Emma imagined, a very sufficient income, since he was known to own some property in addition to the vicarage. He was reckoned very handsome, his person much admired in general, though not by her, there being a want of elegance of feature which she could not dispense with. But the girl who could be gratified by a Robert Martin's riding about the country to get walnuts for her might very well be conquered by Mr. Elton's admiration. It was generally agreed that Emma had found in Harriet a suitable companion and one most looked for in the absence of Mrs. Weston. Mr. Knightley, however, could not approve. And upon visiting Randall's, he found in Mrs. Weston a suitable confidant.
I do not know what your opinion may be, Mrs. Weston, of this great intimacy between Emma and Harriet Smith, but I think they will neither of them do the other any good.
You surprise me. Emma must do Harriet good, and by supplying her with a new object of interest, Harriet may be said to do Emma good. She is not the superior young woman which Emma's friend ought to be, but, on the other hand, as Emma wants to see her better informed, it will be an inducement to her to read more herself. They will read together. She means it, I know.
Emma has been meaning to read more ever since she was 12 years old. I've seen many lists of books that she meant to read. I dare say she may have made out a very good list now, but I've done with expecting any course of steady reading from Emma.
She's been spoiled by being the cleverest of her family. Emma should find a companion who could rival your knowledge and understanding. Instead, she's chosen Harriet Smith, who knows nothing and looks upon Emma as knowing everything. And I do not believe Harriet can gain by the acquaintance either. Hartfield will only put her out of conceit with all the other places she belongs to. She will grow just refined enough to be uncomfortable with those among whom birth and circumstances have placed her home. I cannot believe Emma's doctrines give any strength of mind, or tend at all to make a girl adapt herself rationally to her situation in life. They only give a little polish.
I either depend more upon Emma's good sense than you do, or am more anxious for her present comfort, for I cannot lament the acquaintance. How well she looked last night.
Oh, you would rather talk of her person than her mind, would you? Very well, I shall not attempt to deny Emma's being pretty.
Pretty? Say beautiful, rather. Can you imagine anything nearer perfect beauty than Emma altogether, face and figure?
I confess I have seldom seen a face or figure more pleasing to me than hers, but I am a partial old friend.
Such an eye, the true hazel eye, and so brilliant. Regular features, open countenance, with that bloom of full health, and such a pretty height and size. She is loveliness itself, is not she?
I have not a fault to find with her person. I think her all you describe. I love to look at her, and I will add this praise, that I do not think her personally vain, considering how very handsome she is. She appears to be little occupied with it. Her vanity lies another way. But mark, Mrs. Weston, I am not to be talked out of my dislike of Emma's connection with Harriet Smith, or my dread of its doing them both harm.
And I, Mr. Knightley, am equally stout in my confidence of its not doing them the least bit of harm. With all dear Emma's little faults, she is an excellent creature. Where shall we see a better daughter, or a kinder sister, or a truer friend? She will never lead anyone really wrong. She will make no lasting blunder. Where Emma errs once, she is in the right 100 times.
Very well, I will not plague you any more. I shall keep my ill humour to myself. I cannot but help having a very sincere interest in Emma. However, she seems as much my sister as Isabella. There is an anxiety, a curiosity in what one feels for Emma. I wonder what will become of her.
So do I, very much.
She always declares she will never marry, which of course means nothing at all, but she has not yet seen a man she cared for. It would not be a bad thing for her to be very much in love with a proper object. I should like to see Emma in love, and in some doubt of a return. It would do her good. But there's nobody hereabouts to attach her, and she goes so seldom from home.
You are right that there seems no one who might break her resolution at present. And while she is so happy at Hartfield, I cannot wish her to form any attachment which would create such difficulties for poor Mr. Woodhouse. No, I cannot recommend matrimony at present to Emma, though I mean no slight to the state, I assure you.
Part of her meaning was to conceal some favourite thoughts of her own and Mr. Weston's on the subject as much as possible. There were wishes at Randall's respecting Emma's destiny, but it was not desirable to have them suspected, and the quiet transition which Mr. Knightley soon made to the prospect of rain convinced her that he had nothing more to say or surmise about Hartfield. Emma, in the meanwhile, took great satisfaction in improving Harriet's manner and directing her fancy to Mr. Elton. Harriet was decidedly more sensible than before of Mr. Elton's being a remarkably handsome man with most agreeable manners, and Emma gave her assurance of his admiration by agreeable hints. He talked of Harriet and praised her so warmly that she could not suppose anything wanting which a little time would not add. When the three of them were one day gathered at Hartfield, Emma had a sudden wish to have Harriet's likeness taken. No sooner had her friend left the drawing room than Emma turned to Mr. Elton to share the plan which she had formed that instant.
What an exquisite possession a good picture of Harriet would be. I almost long to attempt her likeness myself. You do not know it, I dare say, but 2 or 3 years ago I had a great passion for taking likenesses. I attempted several of my friends and was thought to have a tolerable eye in general, until from one cause or another I gave it up in disgust. But really, I could almost venture on it again, if Harriet would sit for me. It would be such a delight to have her picture.
Let me entreat you, Miss Woodhouse, to exercise so charming a talent in favour of your friend. I know what your drawings are. Is not this room rich in specimens of your landscapes and flowers? And has not Mrs. Weston some inimitable figure pieces in her drawing room at Randall's?
Emma appeared perfectly composed at this, although her fancy was wildly in motion. It was often the way with Emma, and it was a skill which brought her a good deal of private satisfaction. Upon Mr. Elton's exultations of her skill, Emma thought, "Yes, good man, but what has all that to do with taking likenesses? You know nothing of drawing. Don't pretend to be in raptures about mine. Keep your raptures for Harriet's face." The plan was decided upon, and a proposal made as soon as Harriet was back again. She had no scruples which could stand many minutes against the earnest pressing of both the others. Emma wished to go to work directly, and therefore produced the portfolio containing her various attempts at portraits, for not one of them had ever been finished, that they might decide together on the best size for Harriet.
No great variety of faces for you. I had only my own family to study from. There is my father. Another of my father. But the idea of sitting for his picture made him so nervous that I could only take him by stealth. Neither of them very like, therefore. Mrs. Weston again. And again. And again, you see, dear Mrs. Weston. She would sit whenever I asked her. There is my sister, and really quite her own little elegant figure, and the face not unlike. Then here is my last and my best, Mr. John Knightley. This did not want much of being finished when I put it away in a pet, for after all my pains, Isabella said it was only a little like, but did not do him justice. It was more than I could bear, and I did then forswear ever drawing anybody again. But for Harriet's sake, or rather for my own, and as there are no husbands and wives in the case at present, I will break my resolution now.
No husbands and wives in the case at present indeed, as you observe. Exactly so. No husbands and wives.
Mr. Elton spoke in such a decided tone that Emma began to consider whether she had not better leave him alone with Harriet at once. But as she wanted to be drawing, the declaration must wait a little longer. She had soon fixed on the size and sort of portrait. It was to be a whole length in watercolours. The sitting began, and Harriet, smiling and blushing, presented a very sweet mixture of youthful expression to the steady eyes of the artist. But there was no doing anything with Mr. Elton fidgeting behind Emma and watching every touch.
What judgment? That line is perfection, Miss Woodhouse, just like the last.
Perhaps you could read to us, Mr. Elton. It would be a kindness indeed to make Miss Smith's situation less irksome and mine less difficult.
Of course. I should be only too happy to oblige. Let me look out a book in the library, and when I return, we shall unite literature, art, and beauty. Heavenly, quite heavenly.
The sitting was altogether very satisfactory, and the whole progress of the picture was rapid and happy. There was no want of likeness, and as she meant to add a little more height and considerably more elegance to the figure, when finished, she had great confidence of its being in every way a pretty drawing. The presentation was made at Hartfield. Mr. Woodhouse, Mrs. Weston, and Mr. Elton were the audience.
There. What think you all?
Exquisite, Miss Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Elton.
The expression of the eye is most correct, but Miss Smith has not those eyebrows and eyelashes.
I cannot agree with you there, Mrs. Weston. It appears to me a most perfect resemblance in every feature.
You've made her too tall, Emma.
Oh, no, no, no. Consider, Mr. Knightley, she is sitting down, which naturally presents a different which in short gives exactly the idea, and the proportions must be preserved, you know. Proportions foreshortening. It is exactly as it should be.
It is very pretty, my dear.
Thank you, Papa.
I do not know anybody who draws as well as you do. The only thing I do not thoroughly like is that she seems to be sitting out of doors, with only a little shawl over her shoulders, and it makes one think she must catch cold.
But, my dear Papa, it is supposed to be summer. A warm day in summer. Look at the tree.
But it is never safe to sit out of doors, my dear.
I cannot keep my eyes from it. I never saw such a likeness.
The next thing wanted was to get the picture framed, and here were a few difficulties. It must be done directly. It must be done in London. The order must go through the hands of some intelligent person whose taste could be depended on, and Isabella, the usual doer of all commissions, must not be applied to because it was December and Mr. Woodhouse could not bear the idea of her stirring out of her house in the fogs of December. But no sooner was the distress known to Mr. Elton than it was removed. He could ride to London at any time. It was impossible to say how much he should be gratified by being employed on such an errand. A very few minutes of entreaties and assurances settled the business. Mr. Elton was to take the drawing to London, choose the frame, and give the directions. With a tender sigh, he received the precious deposit. He sighs and studies for compliments rather too much, thought Emma. I come in for a pretty good share of them myself, but it is only his gratitude on Harriet's account. When the very day of Mr. Elton's going to London arrived, it produced a fresh occasion for Emma's services towards her friend. Harriet was due at Hartfield, as usual, soon after breakfast. When she appeared, sooner than had been talked of, she had an agitated, hurried look, announcing something extraordinary to have happened, which she was longing to tell.
Dear Miss Woodhouse, forgive me, you are still at table, but I could not wait.
Harriet, whatever is the matter?
I have news, such news, I cannot believe it.
Come, sit with me.
Who could have thought it? I am so surprised, I do not know what to do. I received this letter just this morning from Mr. Martin. He has made a proposal of marriage. It is a very good letter, at least I think so, and he writes as if he really loves me very much. But I do not know, and so I rushed here as fast as I could to ask you, dear Miss Woodhouse, what I should do.
Upon my word, the young man is determined not to lose anything for want of asking. He will connect himself well if he can.
Will you read the letter? Pray do. I'd rather you would.
Of course I shall.
Oh, thank you. Here it is.
Emma was half ashamed of her friend for seeming so pleased and so doubtful. And yet, the letter surprised her. The style was much above her expectation. There were not merely no grammatical errors, but as a composition it would not have disgraced a gentleman. The language, though plain, was strong and unaffected. It was short, but expressed good sense, warm attachment, liberality, propriety, even delicacy of feeling. She paused over it, while Harriet stood anxiously, watching for her opinion.
Well, is it a good letter, or is it too short?
Yes, indeed, a very good letter. I suppose when he takes a pen in hand, his thoughts naturally find proper words. It is so with some men. Yes, I understand the sort of mind. Vigorous, decided, with sentiments to a certain point, not coarse. A better written letter, Harriet, than I had expected.
Well, and what shall I do?
What shall you do? In what respect? Do you mean with regard to this letter?
Yes.
But what are you in doubt of? You must answer it, of course, and speedily.
Yes, but what shall I say? Dear Miss Woodhouse, do advise me.
No, no, the letter had much better be all your own. You will express yourself very properly, I am sure. Your meaning must be unequivocal, no doubts or demurs, with the proper expressions of gratitude and concern for the pain you are inflicting.
You think I ought to refuse him, then?
Ought to refuse him? My dear Harriet, what do you mean? Are you in any doubt as to that? I thought, but I beg your pardon, I had imagined you knew your answer and were consulting me only as to the wording of it. Do you mean to return a favourable answer?
No, I do not, that is, I do not mean them. What shall I do? What would you advise me to do? Pray, dear Miss Woodhouse, tell me what I ought to do.
I shall not give you any advice, Harriet. I will have nothing to do with it. This is a point which you must settle with your feelings.
I had no notion that he liked me so very much.
For a little while, Emma persevered in her silence, but beginning to apprehend that the bewitching flattery of that letter might be too powerful, Emma thought it best to say,
I lay it down as a general rule, Harriet, that if a woman doubts as to whether she should accept a man or not, she certainly ought to refuse him. I thought it my duty as a friend, and older than yourself, to say thus much to you, but do not imagine that I want to influence you.
Oh, no, I am sure you are a great deal too kind to... But if you would just advise me what I had best do... No, no, I do not mean that. As you say, one's mind ought to be quite made up. One should not be hesitating. It is a very serious thing. It will be safer to say no, perhaps. Do you think I had better say no?
Not for the world would I advise you either way. You must be the best judge of your own happiness. If you prefer Mr. Martin to every other person, if you think him the most agreeable man you have ever been in company with, why should you hesitate? You blush, Harriet. Does anybody else occur to you at this moment under such a definition?
Miss Woodhouse, as you will not give me your opinion, I must do as well as I can by myself. And I have now quite determined and really almost made up my mind to refuse Mr. Martin. Do you think I'm right?
Perfectly, perfectly right, my dearest Harriet. You are doing just what you ought. While you were at all in suspense, I kept my feelings to myself. But now that you are so completely decided, I have no hesitation in approving. Dear Harriet, I give myself joy of this. It would have grieved me to lose your acquaintance, which must have been the consequence of your marrying Mr. Martin. You would have thrown yourself out of all good society. I must have given you up.
You could not have visited me. No, to be sure you could not, but I never thought of that before. It would have killed me never to come to Hartfield any more. However, I do really think Mr. Martin a very amiable young man, and have a great opinion of him. I shall always feel much obliged to him, but certainly I must confess that since my visiting here, I have seen people, and if one comes to compare them, person and manners, there is no comparison at all. One gentleman is so very handsome and agreeable, but as to leaving you, it is what I would not do upon any consideration.
Thank you, my own sweet little friend. We will not be parted. A woman is not to marry a man merely because she is asked, or because he is attached to her and can write a tolerable letter.
Oh, no. I am quite determined to refuse him. But what shall I say?
Emma assured her there would be no difficulty in the answer and advised its being written directly, which was agreed to in the hope of her assistance. And though Emma continued to protest against any assistance being wanted, it was in fact given in the formation of every sentence. Harriet looked over his letter again to form her reply, but it softened her to an alarming degree. Emma even believed that if the young man had come in her way at that moment, he would have been accepted after all. This letter, however, was written and sealed and sent. The business was finished and Harriet safe. She was rather low all the evening, but Emma could allow for her amiable regrets and sometimes relieved them by speaking of her own affection, sometimes by bringing forward the idea of Mr. Elton. It was certainly a cheering idea, but still, later that evening, Harriet was tender-hearted again towards the rejected Mr. Martin.
Now he has got my letter. I wonder what they are all doing, whether his sisters know. If he is unhappy, they will be unhappy too. I hope you will not mind it so very much.
But let us think of those among our absent friends who are more cheerfully employed. At this moment, perhaps Mr. Elton is showing your picture to his mother and sisters, telling how much more beautiful is the original.
My picture? But he has left my picture in Bond Street.
Has he so? Then I know nothing of Mr. Elton.
No, my dear little modest Harriet. Depend upon it, the picture will not be in Bond Street till just before he mounts his horse tomorrow. It is his companion all this evening, his solace, his delight.
Harriet smiled again, and her smiles grew stronger. She slept at Hartfield that night. For some weeks past, she had been spending more than half her time there and gradually getting to have a bedroom appropriated to herself. She was obliged to go the next morning for an hour or two to Mrs. Goddard's, but it was then to be settled that she should return to Hartfield to make a regular visit of some days. While she was gone, Mr. Knightley called and sat with Emma. He began speaking of Harriet, and with more praise than Emma had ever heard before, even acknowledging Emma's part in it.
You have improved her. You have cured her of her schoolgirl's giggle. She really does you credit, and I must tell you that I have good reason to believe your little friend will soon hear something to her advantage.
Indeed. How so? Of what sort?
A very serious sort, I assure you.
Very serious? I can think of but one thing. Who is in love with her? Who makes you their confidant?
I have reason to think that Harriet Smith will soon have an offer of marriage from Robert Martin. He's desperately in love and means to marry her.
He is very obliging. But is he sure that Harriet means to marry him?
Well, he means to make her an offer, then. Will that do? He came to the Abbey 2 evenings ago to consult me about it. He knows I have a thorough regard for him and all his family, and I believe considers me as one of his best friends. I could not wish for another man in England to work my farm. I never hear better sense from anyone than him. He always speaks to the purpose, open, straightforward, and very well judging. I was very much pleased with all that he said of Harriet Smith. He told me everything. His circumstances and plans and what they all proposed doing in the event of his marriage. He proved to me that he could afford it, and that being the case, I was convinced he could not do better. I had no hesitation in advising him to marry. And this happened the night before last, and he is not likely to allow much time to pass before he speaks to the lady. As he does not appear to have spoken yesterday, it's not unlikely that he should be at Mrs. Goddard's for the purpose today.
Pray, Mr. Knightley, how do you know that Mr. Martin did not speak yesterday?
I do not absolutely know it, but it may be inferred.
I will tell you something in return for what you have told me. He did speak yesterday. That is, he wrote and was refused.
Harriet Smith refused Robert Martin? With all his good sense, true heart and genuine affection for her? If this is true, she is a greater simpleton than I ever believed her. What is the foolish girl about?
Oh, to be sure, it is always incomprehensible to a man that a woman should ever refuse an offer of marriage. A man always imagines a woman to be ready for anybody who asks her.
Nonsense. A man does not imagine any such thing. But what is the meaning of this? It is madness. If it is so, but I hope you are mistaken.
I saw her answer. Nothing could be clearer.
You saw her answer? You wrote her answer too, Emma. This is your doing. You persuaded her to refuse him.
And if I did, which, however, I am far from allowing, I should not feel that I had done wrong. Mr. Martin is a very respectable young man, but I cannot admit him to be Harriet's equal.
Not Harriet's equal? No, he is not her equal, indeed, for he is as much her superior in sense as in situation. Emma, your infatuation about that girl blinds you. What are Harriet Smith's claims, either of birth or nature or education, to any connection higher than Robert Martin? She is the natural daughter of nobody knows whom, with probably no settled provision at all, and certainly no respectable relations. The advantage of the match I felt to be all on her side. Even your satisfaction I made sure of. It crossed my mind immediately that you would not regret your friend's leaving Highbury for the sake of her being settled so well.
I must think your statement by no means fair. Mr. Martin may be the richest of the two, but he is undoubtedly her inferior as to rank in society. The sphere in which she moves is much above his. It would be a degradation.
A degradation? For an illegitimate, ignorant girl to be married to a respectable, intelligent gentleman farmer?
As to the circumstances of her birth, though in a legal sense she may be called nobody, it will not hold in common sense. Her father is undoubtedly a gentleman of fortune, for her allowance is very liberal. Nor can you deny that she associates with gentlemen's daughters. She is superior to Mr. Robert Martin.
She is not, nor can she ever be. She was as happy as possible with the Martins in the summer. She had no sense of superiority then. If she has it now, you have given it. You have been no friend to Harriet Smith, Emma. You will puff her up with such ideas of her own beauty and of what she has a claim to that in a little while nobody within her reach will be good enough for her. Vanity, working on a weak head, produces every sort of mischief, and Miss Harriet Smith may not find offers of marriage flow in so fast, though she is a very pretty girl. Men of sense do not want silly wives. Men of family would not connect themselves with a girl of such obscurity. And most prudent men would be afraid of the disgrace they might be involved in when the mystery of her parentage came to be revealed. Let her marry Robert Martin, and she is safe, respectable, and happy forever. But if you encourage her to expect to marry greatly and teach her to be satisfied with nothing less than a man of consequence and large fortune, she may be a parlour boarder at Mrs. Goddard's all the rest of her life, or at least till she grows desperate and is glad to catch at the old writing master's son.
Emma made no answer and tried to look cheerfully unconcerned, but was really feeling uncomfortable and wanting him very much to be gone. She did not repent what she had done. She still thought herself a better judge of such a point of female right and refinement than he could be. But yet she had a sort of habitual respect for his judgment in general, which made her dislike having it so loudly against her. Some minutes passed in an unpleasant silence, with only one attempt on Emma's side to talk of the weather. But he made no answer. He was thinking. The result of his thoughts appeared at last in these words.
Robert Martin has no great loss, if he can but think so, and I hope it will not be long before he does. Your views for Harriet are best known to yourself. But as you make no secret of your love of matchmaking, I shall just hint to you that if Elton is the man, I think it will be all labour in vain.
Oh, how little you know of people.
Depend upon it. Elton will not do. Elton is a very good sort of man and a very respectable vicar of Highbury, but not at all likely to make an imprudent match. Elton may talk sentimentally, but he will act rationally. He knows that he is a very handsome young man and a great favourite wherever he goes. In unreserved moments, when there are only men present, I am convinced that he does not mean to throw himself away. I've heard him speak with great animation of a large family of young ladies that his sisters are intimate with, who have all £20,000 apiece.
Oh, well, I am very much obliged to you. If I had set my heart on Mr. Elton's marrying Harriet, it would have been very kind to open my eyes. But at present, I only want to keep Harriet to myself. I have done with matchmaking indeed.
I hope that is truly the case. Good morning to you, Emma.
Mr. Knightley left abruptly, reproaching himself for the part he had to play in the disappointment of Mr. Martin. He had sanctioned the match while Emma had undone it. Emma remained in her own state of vexation. She did not always feel so absolutely satisfied with herself, so entirely convinced that her opinions were right and her adversaries wrong. He had frightened her a little about Mr. Elton. But Mr. Elton's growing attachment to Harriet would easily overcome any hesitations over money matters. Harriet returned, and her cheerful look and manner established that of her friend, for she spoke not of Mr. Martin, but Mr. Elton. Mr. Perry had met him on the road to London yesterday, and was most surprised to see him missing whist club night, which he had never been known to miss before. Mr. Elton said that he was the bearer of something exceedingly precious. Mr. Perry was convinced there must be a lady in the case. Harriet blushed a little in the telling, but Emma could only smile at such satisfactory progress. Mr. Knightley was so much displeased with Emma that it was longer than usual before he came to Hartfield again, and when they did meet, his grave looks showed that she was not forgiven. She was sorry, but could not repent. On the contrary, her plans and proceedings were more and more justified and endeared to her by the general appearances of the next few days. The picture, elegantly framed, came safely to hand soon after Mr. Elton's return, and being hung over the mantelpiece of the common sitting room, he got up to look at it and sighed out his half sentences of admiration just as he ought. As for Harriet's feelings, they were visibly forming themselves into as strong and steady an attachment as her youth and sort of mind admitted. Emma was soon perfectly satisfied of Mr. Martin's being no otherwise remembered than as he furnished a contrast with Mr. Elton, which was of the utmost advantage to the latter. Her views of improving her little friend's mind by a great deal of useful reading and conversation had never yet led to more than a few first chapters and the intention of going on tomorrow. It was much easier to chat than to study, and the only literary pursuit which engaged Harriet at present was the collecting and transcribing all the riddles, puzzles, and charades of every sort that she could meet with. Emma implored Mr. Elton to assist them with an original composition. Despite his repeated protestations of feeling deeply unequal to such a task, he returned to Hartfield the very next day, just to leave a charade which a friend of his had composed for a young lady, but from his manner Emma was immediately convinced it must be his own. He could not offer the charade for Miss Smith's public collection, since it belonged to his friend, but he thought perhaps Emma may not dislike looking at it. The speech was more to Emma than to Harriet, which Emma could understand. There was deep consciousness about him, and he found it easier to meet her eye than her friend's. He was gone the next moment, and Emma offered the paper to Harriet, whom, she insisted, was the rightful audience. But Harriet was in a tremor and could not touch it, and Emma, never loath to be first, was obliged to examine it herself.
Very well, Harriet. I shall open it myself.
A charade, indeed. Well done, Mr. Elton.
Oh, won't you read it aloud, Miss Woodhouse? I could not possibly read it myself.
Of course I shall. To Miss Dash? Charade. My first displays the wealth and pomp of kings, lords of the earth, their luxury and ease. Another view of man my second brings. Behold him there, the monarch of the seas. But, ah, united what reverse we have. Man's boasted power and freedom all are flown. Lord of the earth and sea, he bends a slave. And woman, lovely woman, reigns alone. Thy ready wit the word will soon supply. May its approval beam in that soft eye.
Emma pondered, caught the meaning, read it through again to be quite certain, and then, passing it to Harriet, sat happily smiling and saying to herself, "An excellent charade indeed, Mr. Elton, and very much to the purpose, although a man must be very much in love indeed to describe Harriet with a ready wit." Harriet paced the room as she puzzled over the paper in all the confusion of hope and dullness.
"What can it be, Miss Woodhouse? I have not an idea. I cannot guess it in the least. Oh, do try to find it out, Miss Woodhouse. Do help me. I never saw anything so hard. Is it kingdom? I wonder who the friend was, and who could be the young lady. Do you think it is a good charade? Can it be woman? And woman, lovely woman, reigns alone. Can it be Neptune? Behold him there, the monarch of the seas. Or a mermaid? Or a shark? Oh, no. Shark is only one syllable. It must be very clever, or he would not have brought it.
Mermaids and sharks? Nonsense. My dear Harriet, what are you thinking of? Where would be the use of his bringing us a charade made by a friend upon a mermaid or a shark?
Miss Woodhouse, do you think we shall ever find it out?
Come and sit beside me.
Oh, yes.
Now, give me the paper and listen. For Miss Dash, read Miss Smith. My first displays the wealth and pomp of kings, lords of the earth, their luxury and ease. That is court.
Ah.
Another view of man my second brings. Behold him there, the monarch of the seas. That is ship, plain as can be.
Of course.
Now for the cream. But, ah, united, courtship, you know. What reverse we have, man's boasted power and freedom all are flown. Lord of the earth and sea, he bends a slave, and woman, lovely woman, reigns alone. A very proper compliment.
Do you really believe such a compliment is meant for me?
But of course, my dear Harriet. Listen to the application that follows. Thy ready wit the word will soon supply. May its approval beam in that soft eye. There is so pointed a meaning in this compliment that I cannot have a doubt as to Mr. Elton's intentions. You are his object, and you will soon receive the completest proof of it. I congratulate you, my dear Harriet, with all my heart. This is an attachment which a woman may feel pride in creating. This is a connection which will give you everything that you want. Consideration, independence, a proper home close to Hartfield and to me, and confirms our intimacy forever. This, Harriet, is an alliance which can never raise a blush in either of us.
Dear Miss Woodhouse, whatever you say is always right, and therefore I suppose and believe and hope it must be so. But otherwise I could have not imagined